Well, good afternoon, and thank you for being here. It is a real thrill for me to be up on this podium, and a double thrill because I just saw John Denson walk in and spoke to him. He and Lou and their fellow conspirators organized the first version of this Costs of War conference years ago, I think 28, if I'm making the numbers work out. And it was the very first Mises meeting I ever went to. I was there as just a you know, visitor and a listener. But they had me at Eugene Sledge, who was on the program and wrote probably the greatest war memoir, regarded by historians as the great war memoir of all time, about the Pacific War in World War II. But in any case, I met there Lou and Mr. Denson, and I met Murray Rothbard and Bob Higgs and a host of others. So I'm just on cloud nine to be here today. Okay, well, before I start, I want to point out something, and that is that Mises and Hayek were both artillery officers. But don't get too excited. So were Napoleon Bonaparte and Harry Truman. So, my paper's about three or four different strands of history that work into World War I, and I want to try to put them all together today. It may be hard, but I think I can do it. The rise of the aggressive new state around 1500, that's in the time of Machiavelli, who very much approved of it. This time coincided with the rise of gunpowder weapons, and my topic today is especially the artillery part of those weapons. As powerful artillery, especially field artillery, reached real functionality, states achieved power and expansion using that weapon. It served, after all, both military purposes abroad and internal security functions at home. And as an expensive weapon, it helped justify accelerating expropriation through taxes and inflation. But the cost of artillery soon far exceeded internal fiscal limits. So power-hungry states gradually learned to borrow money from favored money concerns, creatures of the state, which at times wagged the dog very definitely. But artillery achieved its slow, steady climb as an increasing component of military. So there was more artillery relative to the entire military as time went on. The rising costs of more and better artillery and more sophisticated ammunition helped accelerate the state's size and reach for 400 years as an ever more expensive prop of the state, reaching a denouement on the battlefields of the First World War, one so powerful that it would help set up the world for the future omnipotent state. This general pattern had been refined by the time of the Great War. The 1934 book, Merchants of Death, by Engelbrecht and Hannigan, focused on the recent relations between arms and the state during the run-up to the war, especially the malign influence of international arms makers. The authors pointed out the paradox of arms makers supplying weapons globally. They were real internationalists before the war. But at home, they spoke out for chauvinistic autarky, hard nationalism. So two different views. These arms makers did this as favored cronies of the state, subsidized and treated as an extra branch of government. They were also helped by the state in all the arrangements of the classical cartel. Yet in the preface to Merchants of Death, early revisionist historian Harry Elmer Barnes added a dimension to this. Arms merchants, he wrote, quote, never exerted so terrible an influence upon the promotion of warfare as did our American bankers between 1914 and 1917. In the U.S. context, Barnes meant the J.P. Morgan empire and related interests, a subject which Murray Rothbard explored extensively and repeatedly. All of us think often about the meeting at Jekyll Island in 1910, but we should also think of the same elites at that same moment deeply involved in state-backed consortium loans to far-flung countries aimed not only at profit and financial control of these countries, but regime change as well, helping overthrow governments who resisted extensive debt. From 1905 to 1916, nearly 40% of the Earth's population experienced regime change via revolution. Each of these pre-war revolutions were prefaced by international loans, forced currency changes, and related measures. Revolutions in Turkey, China, Mexico, and elsewhere put into power new and friendly elites open to further loans and concomitant social changes. Closely allied arms makers often kept the mayhem going just for good measure in these areas where they had revolutions. Rothbard's brilliant 1989 article, War as Fulfillment, has taught us that beyond economic hegemony, coalescing elites harbored wide-ranging plans based on dreams of pliable citizens who would go meekly into a progressive world guided by wise rationalists. New modern governments in 1910, 12, 16, 11, new modern governments could help drive that vision. In any case, my point here is that before the Archduke was assassinated, these elites had a lot of experience in changing regimes. Not unrelated, in the decades before 1914, artillery underwent technical transformations. Military historians sometimes call this transformation the quick-firing revolution. In fact, new speed of firing joined other innovations to alter the battlefield of the future. Given these changes, thinkers at the turn of the century took worried note and studied the potential change in future wars. The most prominent was a Polish banker named Jan Bloch, who published a book in 1899 about this question, a deep study. And he painted a very grim picture of the future. He said that battlefield will be an environment of flying superheated metal and massive explosions far more deadly than the deadliest battlefields of the past. A storm of steel, in the later words of Western front fighter Ernst Jünger. From this uncannily accurate vision, Bloch drew a second conclusion. He thought the future war would be either short and violent or simply impossible. No existing governments, he said, could afford to fight such a war for more than a few months. They would use up so much of their national resources, so much artillery, so many shells, they would just be unable to carry the war on for very long. So he thought that in the end, governments would do the right thing, that they would be rational, that they would never commit to a suicidal conflict. Because he said the end of that will be social disaster and revolution. And he said they won't do it. So it's not an optimistic sounding book, but it's an optimistic book when you read it, but it's in the end, he's an optimist. This short war illusion, shared by many, helped condition both decision makers and the public to expect the next big war to be brief, if violent. From the pre-war military planners to the young men who flooded recruiting stations in 1914 in hopes of getting to the front before the war was over, the short war illusion was shared by many in the West. The creator of the great Schlieffen Plan wrote, "A strategy of exhaustion is impossible when the maintenance of millions necessitates the expenditure of billions." In 1914, the German Kaiser sent troops off to the front with the words, "You will be home again before the leaves have fallen from the trees." they were not wrong about what should have happened. Short war, negotiated peace, some boundary changes, then back to normal. But bankers, above all American ones, would make available through financial manipulation and the ruthless inflationary policies which the state adopted to extend the storm of steel for years. Certainly, American intervention in 1917 unbalanced the war. Yet even before the Americans upset the stalemate, the proven strategies of banking, arms merchants, and corporatist governments subsidized a war that should have been impossible. It is no stretch to think that these forces helped turn the short war into a long one. The means, in my mind, was largely munitions production. Could negotiations have, forestalled a long war? Well, there were many early peace efforts from Pope Benedict XV, who had proposals already out in the war in 1914, to officials on both sides at the same time. Even Wilson's advisor, Colonel House, had been sent to Europe to encourage negotiations there. He talked peace, although his special sell was to sell Wilson as mediator. Yet in talking to highly placed government officials, diplomats and whatnot, the Germans told House bluntly that neutral America's sales of arms to Britain and France stood in the way of such talks. Another point stood in the way for the British and French, who agreed with House that any negotiations must include the removal of the Kaiser and his regime of militarism. So, a regime change. Back in America, the president met with his political backer, J.P. Morgan, who was also a banker, as the war was starting. Their conversation probably reflected a letter that the elder Morgan's son, Jack, so the son of J.P. Morgan, Jack, wrote to Wilson in September 1914, so early in the war. The war, he wrote, should be a tremendous opportunity for America. The resulting financial story has been told many times. Briefly, the J.P. Morgan Group loaned the Entente powers billions, as did the U.S. government, with Morgan's as the official go-between. In all these transactions, as well as the agent of all Allied increasing purchasing contracts. So J.P. Morgan was both the purchaser and the lender. Huge business was funneled to the Morgan-related Powder Trust, which by December 14th, that is DuPont, the company DuPont, had orders totaling 13 times its pre-war capacity for explosives. But the subsidized boom in shells, and I wrote that on purpose, boom in shells. I hope you'd see what I've done. The subsidized boom in shells rapidly drew hundreds of American private firms and even city governments into the armament business. Of course, all belligerents also subsidized their own. To connect all this to the scenes of slaughter, I concentrate here on the dreadful Western Front. The war in the West, and there were many fronts in the war, I'm sure everybody knows that. The war in the West began when Germany invaded Belgium and northern France in early August. After 2 months of furious mobile battles, the German Schlieffen plan to take Paris failed. On the defensive, the Germans fell back to well-prepared entrenched positions. The Allies tried to outflank these. The Germans followed suit. And by October, the two sides faced each other in trenches across a stationary no-man's land stretching from the Swiss border to the Belgian coast, nearly 400 miles. Breakthrough? Well, yes, but how? A number of weapons were tried, poison gas, flamethrowers, but in the end, it seemed that the most obvious way to break through would be to pound the enemy the enemy trenches with shells and try to kill or drive off everybody there and then drive through. As French Field Marshal Pétain said in 1916, artillery conquers, infantry occupies. Allied governments, having secured the funds for seemingly infinite shelling, Allied commanders followed the whole program. And the Germans did too, after a while. So battles soon consisted of days-long bombardments, then over the top. This meant that shells with high explosive, shrapnel, and later gas-filled and heavy metal incendiary shells were pounded on the battlefield, churning up soil and men. Totals of shells rose dramatically throughout the conflict, with improvements that increased their killing power. The French expenditures of shells on the front rose by a factor of five during the war. By 1918, the Germans were firing 8 million shells per month, the Allies not far behind. Two-thirds of the men who died in France and Belgium perished from artillery fire. It was indeed the storm of steel, but with an extended time frame previously thought impossible. American forces were on the front lines for less than a year, but the bodies of 4,400 Americans from World War I are still missing, not unidentified. They're missing. The gruesome total for other armies numbers many tens of thousands. I probably don't have to mention to you the even higher numbers of wounded and disfigured, or massive psychological problems among survivors of weeks of shell fire. Some never recovered from this shell shock. Nor did many at home, recover from the physical, social, cultural, and spiritual stresses of the deaths of 5 million men on all fronts from artillery. Averaging $10 a shell, the cost was truly astronomical. Indeed, at home, increasing deaths on the battlefront challenged governments trying to keep their home populations mobilized. One method was to sensationalize periodic shell shortages on the front as shell crises. This is very much part and parcel of the techniques that Robert Higgs brilliantly demonstrated in his masterpiece, Crisis and Leviathan. That is to say, crisis, then state response, always at the expense of liberties. The British pioneered this shell crisis technique with the shell scandal of April 1915. Here's how it worked. In a British attack around the French village of Neuve-Chapelle, soldiers captured the village, but ran out of steam as they wheeled and drove beyond and assaulted the Germans ensconced on the Aubert Ridge. The attack failed under German machine gun fire and German counterattack. But at that moment, the high command had ended these divisions' promiscuous artillery fire. They had just fired off 15% of the total of the British Army. So they stopped that. The British commander, the overall commander, embarrassed by failure, but seeing a real opportunity, contacted a patriotic journalist to break the story of the shell scandal, the boys on the front being, as it were, betrayed by half-hearted measures at home. This was grist for the mill of Liberal Party politician David Lloyd George, loud proponent of draconian measures. His proposal, a few weeks before the shell scandal, all engineering works of the country ought to be turned to the production of war material. The population ought to be prepared to suffer all sorts of deprivations and hardships. Indeed, the scandal crisis created a new Ministry of Munitions in Britain, headed by Lloyd George, with free rein now to inflict hardships as he mobilized the country. France soon founded one in turn, this one under the French one under Socialist Party leader Albert Thomas. And the Germans followed suit with their Hindenburg plan, that totalitarian plan, which also had an organization for munitions. All three of these organs were devoted to central planning without regard to individual depredations. And all three inflicted their visions on populations already suffering from tax increases, inflation, and the malinvestments which accompany central planning in every case. Explosive shells may represent the ultimate malinvestment, considering that what their purpose is in battle. But the industry additionally inflicted unjust injuries at home and killed many workers itself. Shell assembly required a long list of metals and chemicals, most of them toxic. Who did this dangerous work? In the United States, by 1918, 1.5 million individuals worked on munitions. In Britain, over 2 million, and so forth. Over a third of all these workers in all countries were women, mostly from the working class. Recent evidence suggests that of the many married women workers in the plants, a majority were wives of soldiers. As entry-level workers, nearly all women were assigned to assembly. Well, that was the job closest to all of these substances. Many indeed died from toxins or were rendered scarred or infertile. The chemicals often turned the skin of the workers yellow, in some cases from liver damage. The appearance of these yellowed female workers was so alarming that propaganda coined a jaunty designation. They called them canary girls. Their yellow skin, you see, proving their patriotism. One thing they had to deal with was gun cotton. That's an explosive mixture of nitrocellulose, some solvents and reactants, sulfuric acid, and some other things. All this was stuffed along with other explosions with TNT and other explosives into shells. In a publicity visit to the munitions plant at Gretna, Scotland, patriotic war writer Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, yes, that Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, dubbed this gun cotton mixture as the devil's porridge. He did this after he had seen the canary girls mixing gun cotton on the floor of the factory with their bare hands. On all home fronts, hundreds of plant explosions resulted in thousands dead. For example, 200 munitions workers perished in the German city of Thorn in a plant explosion in 1917. 300 later, not far away from a fire. Another 200 died at the Aetna Works in Pittsburgh in 1916. 134 at a Nottinghamshire plant in 1918, and on and on and on. The majority of the dead were women. Newspapers kind of avoided this topic and didn't give many details. We may not know how many women died in these, but there are some records. But clearly, the press was censored so that nobody walked around talking about all the women dying in munitions production. To conclude, one might well consider artillery a crucial nexus between the battlefronts, societies, and the state. The industrialized war, prolonged and intensified by the influence of arms makers and bankers for their own ends, connected intimately to the home fronts, which were undergoing measures of the coming omnipotent state far beyond the imagination of Machiavelli. The dirty business of mixing the devil's porridge serves as one of the many symbols of the engineered violence and of the total states of generations to come. And on the battlefronts, men hunkered down in trenches as shells screamed overhead from the rear, shells likely enough assembled by their wives or sweethearts. Thank you.